everybody, and welcome to our August edition of our Care Partner Meetup. We are glad you are here, and we are very happy that we have a special guest, Dr. Mark Mapstone, with us today. And without further ado, Ms. Connie Carpenter-Finney.
Hey, everyone. Welcome. And thanks to my co-panelists, Pat Donahue, who you know if you've been here before because he's a regular. And welcome, Mark Mapstone, who's almost a regular. We've had you on at least once or twice a year since we started doing this. So thanks for being here, Mark. We really appreciate it.
Got it.
We've got a lot to talk about, and we have so much to talk about that we invited you for back-to-back Care Partner meetups, which means we are going to talk again in a month. but I wanted to also let you know that Gail is on vacation and she could not sign in from Iceland. So those of you who know Gail and love Gail, as we all do, one of my co-panelists here, she's up on a vacation. So that's awesome. First time, I think, for her to Iceland. So we're going to do a lot today, but I want to first just remind you that we're here to support you. And while we will talk about your person with Parkinson's and we will try to answer questions, especially since we have a specialist here, we're also really trying to help you. Okay, so when you think about your questions, think about you, what your needs are around the issue of caring for your person with Parkinson's. It's kind of a fine line that we try to dance here. And I think before we go to the poll even, Mark, why don't we just let people know who you are? We've got quite a group listening in, and just give us a quick introduction.
Sure. Yeah, I'm seeing all of the folks signing in on the chat. It's amazing the breadth of participation across. I see Alaska, I see Florida, California, West Coast, New York. Wonderful to have you all here today. I'm really excited when I get invited to this. I always wait for the emails from Connie and I get all excited because I know that I'm going to be invited to come and join you guys. So I'm very happy to be here. My name is Mark Mapstone. I am a clinical neuropsychologist. And what that means is that I am somebody who tries to understand how diseases of the brain affect our thinking and emotional health. So this includes, of course, things like Parkinson's disease, but also things like Alzheimer's disease and traumatic brain injury and other sorts of things. So disruptions of the brain and how it works and how that impacts the way that we can function and live our lives, and in particular, how we think and do things like memory. I am a professor of neurology at the University of California at Irvine. I'm the chief of the neuropsychology service. I'm a vice chair. I wear a lot of hats. So I'm involved in a lot of things. But one of the major things that I do is I work in research. And we are working to find things that we can detect in the blood that can tell us if people are going to get a neurodegenerative disease like Parkinson's disease. So we're trying to determine new ways that we can screen for risk for these diseases like Parkinson's before they become manifest, before you start to see that first shaking of the hand or the tremor or the difficulty walking. We want to be able to know who's going to get these diseases early so that we can begin hopefully treatments and try and prevent or slow down these things. So my role here today is to help you to understand and maybe educate a little bit about some of the changes that can happen in Parkinson's disease as far as your thinking and emotional state. And then things that you can do as care partners to keep yourselves healthy. I think that that's a really critical thing that I hope you all, if you haven't heard this before, is you need to really focus on yourself and your own emotional and spiritual health as well in order to do the best that you can for your person with Parkinson's disease. So yeah. I will stop there, but that's me.
Yay, that's you. And we're going to just ask everyone, we're going to do a poll. We're so happy you're here, Mark. And Pat, I'm really happy you're here. And I just want everybody to know that Pat starts back to school. He's a school teacher in Las Vegas. His wife, Sid, has Parkinson's. And we really rely on Pat for his wise counsel and contributions. And happy you're here, Pat.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a new classroom. I'm stuck in a room. I've got a place. I've always been wherever I was last time. So, it's good.
You look good. You look like you had a good summer. I'm happy. Anyway, hey, Polly, let's look at that poll
Yeah.
real quick. We like to know a little bit about our listeners, just so we can target. And while you're filling out the poll, also be thinking of questions you might want to throw out to us. Throw out to us, and let us know what you're thinking about in this whole sphere of, mental health, wellness, neuropsychological complications with your person with Parkinson's, maybe your own anxiety, maybe their anxiety. Let's talk. Polly, let's find out
Great.
Who's listening.
Super. We have a poll that has three questions in it. It will be served up all at once for you, so you can answer the three questions.
Great.
First question, can you see it, everybody?
Yep.
Great. First question, how long have you been attending these care partner meetups? How long have you been caring for someone with Parkinson's? And how concerned are you about your person with Parkinson's experiencing declining cognition? Okay, I am going to end the poll and I'm going to share the results so that everybody can see who's here. So 15% of you are new. Welcome. We hope you'll come back. And the majority of you, well, 50% of you have been, 60% of you have been living with Parkinson's in your family for more than 5 years.
Can you scroll that down? Because I can only see part of the answers to number two on my screen.
I don't have the ability to.
I do. Okay, I can do it. Never mind. I got it.
That's right. You're probably teaching somebody else the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So we're scrolling on the quiz page. Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. Wow. Lots of experience in this crowd. I'm sorry. I share your experience. I'm 20 plus now. So, Pat, how many years are you?
2010.
So you're closing in on 15, my friend. Okay. How concerned are you about your person with Parkinson's?
Cognition? You're asking me?
Yeah, no. I'm just looking at their. We'll get your feedback on that in a minute. I know you got something to say. All right, mildly concerned. So like about a third of you are sort of in the mild. Concerns are quickly growing. That's good, Mark. We got people with concerns that are growing. And we have 15%, which is a pretty healthy number as well, thinking this is keeping me up at night. So, okay.
Lots to talk about.
Yeah, we've got lots to talk about. So thank you, everyone, for filling out the poll. That does help inform our conversation. Pat, do you want to lead off? Because you have some questions for Mark. And then I see a ton of questions in the chat, Polly.
Yeah. I'm capturing them.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. All right. Okay.
I'm dealing with a lot of anxiety still, not myself, but with my wife. She has DBS, and she's kind of an outlier on the DBS program because she has diphasic dyskinesia, and you have to look that up if you want to know more about it. But the diphasic dyskinesia, you have dyskinesia when you're coming on and when you're going off. And right now she's currently not using any carbidopa levodopa. She's relying 100% on the DBS as far as, and we've got that.
Wait one second, just to make sure everybody knows what DBS is. So deep brain stimulation is a surgical intervention for people with Parkinson's. Not everyone is a candidate. And probably a good percentage of you have, your person has had that. It's not a novel procedure. But anyway, so sorry, Pat, I just want to make sure.
It's fine. Everyone has different experiences with DBS. I tend to look at the positives that we've had, the loss of, the gain, she's gained her mobility. She's not as rigid as she used to be before DBS. And so forth, but we're dealing with the anxiety. She just had a new power plant or the battery replaced a couple months ago, and lots of great things with that new technology that came along with that. But that's helped her in her diphasic programming. But the she still has that anxiety when she's in a certain program, and the thing about it is that it gets worse, it gets better. We spent a month and a half I wrote across the country 2 months ago, I was in a U-Haul truck on this call, so it was.
Yeah, that's right.
but she was socializing. She was out of the heat of Vegas. She was up in the mountains. Well, we were in Kansas too, but it was cool there. So there's a lot of aspects that got her away from that anxiety. But as soon as we came back, it just sparked right back up. Not that she didn't have it while we were on our journeys, but it became enhanced.
So do you think your question, maybe your question to Mark then, is around why or how to duplicate the environment you had when she was doing better?
Well, one of the things that I have to work on is how do I handle it? You know, how do I deal with the constant changing? The changing, there's no anxiety right now. And then a minute later or 2 minutes, an hour later, there's more anxiety and it's bam, it hits me in the face. Mm-hmm. How do I adjust myself to it? Also with that, her speech has become a little bit off. With that program, and then hopefully they'll work on that today. We're going this afternoon to the MDS.
Can I also pipe in to say that I think, and Mark, this is something I experienced with my husband, is that the speech, the softening of speech and the inability to understand everything is a real huge frustration for us caregivers and leads to a lot of silence, I think, at the end of the day, because you can't. It's hard to understand, right? And that leads to them being more isolated and us being more isolated too, right? So
yeah, that's a tough one. The characteristic is called hypophonia, which means low speech, and you combine that with so it's the low volume, so the volume goes down, and you combine that with the motor aspects of poor articulation, and you get kind of this slurry, rushed, low volume speech that it can often be unintelligible.
Yeah.
So it really is a big problem. And the biggest issue, as you point out, is it does lead to isolation because they can't communicate. It's much more difficult to communicate mm-hmm. with people. People can't understand what they're saying, and then you can't communicate back. And so you need to start thinking about ways that you can facilitate the transfer of ideas and thoughts. So it doesn't have to be verbal, as you know. However, there are also other motor things that preclude writing, for writing in a notepad or something like that. The best thing to do in sort of from what I've noticed is to maximize the times when he's not having those problems mm-hmm. and do the bulk of your communication then. So if he's good in the morning, right after he takes his dose or, reprograms his DBS stimulator, then, maybe that's the time that you sit down for a chat and talk about meaningful things and use that time that you have available to you and maximize that as much as you can, because you're absolutely right. It's really hard to do anything about that.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. And then I think there are times you're right when he's better, and then we do have a pretty, quick back and forth. But what about you, Pat? Is Sid's symptoms are new, and so you're now just experiencing them?
Well, you mentioned slurred speech. I called it, you're talking like a drunken sailor. And then we got. I went back and apologized and said we're not going to use that term anymore. But the slurred speech, and I'm hard of hearing myself, and also I have tinnitus, and I have my challenges. We're talking about learning American Sign Language, maybe, but which is an option. If I have her just calm down, focus, and everything. And we're at the point now where I've gotten over the slurred speech. I've adjusted to that, but it's now it's how do we make it better? How do we communicate?
Well, to your point about anxiety, or sort of the comment that you brought up with DBS and this biphasic dyskinesias that are coming on and off. This is basically the result of a particular the brain that's being stimulated. I presume that this is subthalamic nucleus STN stimulation, which is predominantly where they're doing the stimulation these days. And it's important to know that that particular area of the brain has an overlap of a lot of different pathways. Some of them are for thinking cognitive abilities. Some of them are for emotional abilities, Our ability to regulate anxiety or mood state, depression, things like this. And then the third pathway are motor pathways. And so it's really important when you talk to your neurologist who's programming the stimulator, so the pulse generator that's being activated in the stimulation that's happening, they are tailoring that for the movement. And the problem is that those other pathways can be affected. The cognitive and the emotional pathways can also be affected. But typically, your neurologist or your advanced nurse practitioner is going to adjust the parameters so that you get optimal movement, so that they walk better, that they're not falling, that they're able to pick up a coffee cup. That's what they're adjusting these things for, typically, unless you have a really nuanced. Some neurologists and others are really good about this, but it's important when you go in there, and if you're getting adjusted at the clinic, you know, let them know that anxiety is a problem, and she's having wearing off and coming on anxiety, and that maybe they want to back up the probes that are actually in the brain, have different little targets that they can turn on one and turn off another, and different ways to modify where in the brain they're stimulating, and they might be able to adjust it. It all depends on where the surgeon got the stimulator probe in. So if you ask the surgeons,
you think they put it in the wrong place, but that's another story.
But the surgeons will always say, no, it's exactly where it needs to be. But the reality is that it can vary. So there's a limitation as to where they can adjust these pulse parameters. But if you go in and tell them anxiety is a problem and I want to reduce some of that, they may be able to change some of the parameters so that you get you don't have as much of that.
And Mark, and I know probably we have a ton of questions, but why is anxiety such a big factor for people with Parkinson's, irrespective of if they have DBS? I mean, it is a huge, what is that pathway that contributes for a person with Parkinson's? Is it biochemical or neurochemical or?
Well, it is. So we have to remember that Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. It's a disease in which cells in the brain, the neurons, are dying off. And these particular cells are make a neurotransmitter or a chemical called dopamine and other neurotransmitters. But this is a key chemical in the brain that's necessary for cognitive networks, emotional networks, and motor or movement networks. So dopamine plays a role in all of these things. And if your brain is not making as much of that, those pathways are not firing the way that they should. And so you're getting changes there. The other reason why anxiety and depression is a big problem is because, frankly, your person with Parkinson's disease is dealing with a life-altering illness, a neurodegenerative illness. It's getting worse. And if it doesn't take much to put yourself in their shoes and say, boy, how would I react to this? Would it make me anxious if I'm going to fall, if I'm afraid of falling down because my motor skills, or I'm out having a cup of coffee with my girlfriends and, you know, I'm shaking all over the place? I mean, yeah, that could make a normal person very anxious. So some of this is reactive or reaction to the things that are happening. And some of it is also biochemical. It's actually a change in the biochemistry in the brain due to the dying off of these cells and the downstream effects of that.
So it's multifaceted.
Yeah. It can vary in different people. I mean, some people might not be worried about falling. Maybe that's not a problem. But yeah, those are some of the major reasons why.
Okay.
So I just wanted to add that as a care partner, it's important that we adjust and everything. And that's what I've been going through the last month, is making these adjustments. And because they can't help, she can't help what she's doing. And in some cases, I can't help what I'm doing, but we can come together and come up with paths to take care of that challenge between the two of us, you know, everything. I mean, we're going to talk to the doctor today about how to fix it.
Keep going, Pat, you're doing it. Yeah. All right, Holly, where should we start?
Oh my gosh, so many questions from the audience. I'm going to focus on the ones that Dr. Mapstone, that Mark here can maybe address better, and we'll save some of the others for later if we can get to them. First question that I've come across, my husband was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment in February. Is there any idea how quickly this might progress? Asks Diane.
Mild cognitive impairment is a change in cognitive function, usually memory, but not always. It can be, in Parkinson's disease, executive dysfunction, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But it's a change in cognitive function that does not significantly impact functional capacity. So you're still able to do what you need to do. You can go to the store and, might forget an item or something like that, but it's not really limiting your ability to live in your space due to the cognitive problems. When it goes on to impact your functional capacity, meaning you're forgetting things that are important, like to turn off the stove after you've used it or to lock the doors at night, and there's safety issues or that impacts your cognitive function, that then meets criteria for what we call dementia. So I want to just point out MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, is not dementia. And many people with Parkinson's, it will progress to it, and roughly about two-thirds. But not everybody with Parkinson's disease has MCI or dementia. There is a significant proportion who do not get significant cognitive impairments. Most people do. And so if your person with Parkinson's has been diagnosed with MCI, this is just indicating that they've got a demonstrable cognitive impairment that someone could measure. You could give a memory test to them and they would not do as well as they should. So there's something they can measure, but it's not really that significant to impact their functional capacity. And the question is, how does this progress? In many people with MCI, about two-thirds of people with MCI will go on to develop cognitive impairments that impact functional capacity, and that, by the rule book, meets criteria for a dementia. So Parkinson's dementia is a real thing. There is a dementia that's associated with Parkinson's disease. It's different from the kind that the prototypical dementia that we think of in Alzheimer's disease, where memory is the worst problem. People with Alzheimer's disease forget things. They lose information. The part of the brain that does that is not working right. Parkinson's dementia or cognitive impairments are different. They tend to be of the dysexecutive subtype, which means they are problems with planning, working out sort of multi-step tasks. Like if you're cooking a meal and you've got to put in the salt before you put in the spices, and then you've got to sear the thing, and then you've got to put it out and put it in the oven. Having all of those steps in a row is difficult to maintain and keep track of. We also think about multitasking, the ability to handle multiple things at once. People with Parkinson's disease who have this trouble can't juggle multiple things, and they need to stick with one thing and one thing only. They can get through that, and then they move on to the next. So they work in serial rather than in parallel. So when they've got a cognitive task, you give one thing and then you go on to the next once they've completed it. Don't try and give multiple things at once. It's going to overwhelm their system. So those are the typical kinds of executive function problems. You might also get tip of the tongue phenomena, which is having a word that they know that they want to say. It's right there, and you, as a person talking with them, you can even see it. You know what they're trying to say, and they're trying to come up with it, and they just can't get it out. That's a cognitive problem. It's not a motor problem typically. And in those cases, I recommend that you wait for them. Wait, let them have the success of finding it. If they get too frustrated and start to get angry, then obviously you jump in and say, "Do you want me to help you with that word?" Then do that. But otherwise, let them have the success. It's important to allow them to have those little, "I'm looking for this word and I know it." And then once they get it, they feel good about themselves. And any of you out there in midlife know that this happens to all of us. So it's the sort of thing that's very common, but it's much more frequent in people. That's MCI. It will often progress. In a very small percentage, it will stay stable, meaning not get worse, or sometimes it might even revert, meaning you go back to not having the cognitive problems. Typically, that's because there's a concurrent diagnosis of depression or some sort of mood disorder that can cause memory loss that looks a lot like MCI, but it's not. And once you treat the memory, the depression, the memory comes back a little bit.
Well, and also, a lot of people are asking about sleep disturbances and things because exhaustion is such a part. Like, I know when I'm exhausted, I don't think clearly, right? And so it's hard to separate in a person with Parkinson's sometime because they are almost always exhausted, in my experience, because the disease takes such a toll 24/7. And if it would only take a toll during the day when you're trying to move or function, it'd be one thing. It takes a toll all night long. And so I think that isn't that's hard to separate too, right? The exhaustion from actual cognitive impairment.
Absolutely. We all know that when you're tired, even without Parkinson's disease, you're not thinking straight. So a good night's sleep is important. And unfortunately, some of the chemicals that are disrupted in Parkinson's disease, the brain chemicals, are important for regulating sleep. And so you do get sleep disruption as part of this disease, that it's biological. You're really not going to fix that necessarily. There are some drugs, obviously, that can help you sleep, but they tend not to give you good quality sleep.
I mean,
that you get naturally from, you know, you go out and do a century ride on your bike and then you come back and boy, you're going to crash and you're going to have a good sleep in which you become refreshed. And that kind of sleep is really hard to get once you get Parkinson's without these biochemicals that are necessary for that.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Thanks. All right, Holly.
Anne says, I know that other Parkinson's symptoms fluctuate, but how can thinking come and go?
Yeah, it's a really good question. But if you think about it a little bit, do a little introspection about your own abilities. When you wake up first thing in the morning, do you always feel like you're right on the ball? And I personally wake up a little groggy and it takes me a little time. And, you know, by the time I'm out of the shower and I'm getting dressed and things are starting to click and I'm running on all cylinders. But things do fluctuate in the normal state. And particularly as we get older, things do move up and down. And there's a periodicity within the day. As we go through our days, there are good times for us to be cognitively active, and there are other times when we're not so good. There's circadian rhythms, there's seasonal rhythms, there's sleep contributions like we just talked about. So these things do fluctuate, but it's more dramatic in people with Parkinson's disease because of the lack of these chemicals and the dying off of certain cells in the brain. We don't know why those cells die off, and we don't know how to really protect them. So we're still, science has not gotten us there yet. We're working hard on it, but we just don't know. So right now, you know, those fluctuations are going to be more noticeable. And when you combine the fatigue and the frustration and the emotional stuff, all of that's going to exaggerate all of this. And so it does ebb and flow. And in particular with the medications or the treatments, the DBS, as we just talked about, the deep brain stimulation, can cause fluctuations in thinking, emotions, and movement. And you can see the movements fluctuate. You can see that there are times when they're coming off their meds or in their stimulation parameters, they get better and then they get worse. They go on and they come off. The exact same thing is happening to mood and emotion because of those networks are overlapping at a critical crossroads in the brain called the basal ganglia. So these things all move together and they move independently from each other, but they can all vary and fluctuate. So you're going to see cognitive fluctuations.
And just to just sort of think about that as a care partner, all of us, that this is one of our challenges, right? Like we don't know what the road looks like, you know, tomorrow, much less a year from now or 5 years from now, right? So going back to the Olympics analogy where you can train knowing, you know, like you're going to be built, you have building blocks, you're going to be training yourself to get better. But the person with Parkinson's is just trying not to get worse.
Yes.
And you as the care partner are sitting there going, well, why are you good today? And you know, what's happening? And you were so horrible yesterday, you know, not horrible, but you know what I mean? It's like, you couldn't function. And so it's frustrating. It adds to our frustration, right? And I think that this is, you know, one of the huge challenges. And it's good to hear you explain, you know, why it happens. And so for us to sort of go, oh yeah, okay. And they're not trying to be difficult. Sometimes I do. Let's just do that. But you know, they're not trying to do that. They would much rather be steady and building toward better rather than trying to just not get worse. So anyway, so thank you for clarifying that. Polly, yeah. What's next?
Yeah. Is that difficulty with problem solving and creative thinking a sign of cognitive decline for a person with Parkinson's?
Those are particular issues. Yes, of course. Those are executive functions. That's the front of the brain, the frontal lobes of the brain that do those sorts of things. So creativity, ways to consider new alternatives to things. People with Parkinson's tend to have a very rigid or inflexible approach. They do things one way and that's how they do it. And they're comfortable with that. It's hard to get them out of that set. We call this a set shifting problem. So yes, it's very common to have problems with cognitive flexibility, the ability to think creatively or differently. And we call this perseveration, which mm-hmm. means that they get stuck in one way of responding all the time. And sometimes that's good. It's adaptive because, hey, this works and I know I can do this and I'm going to think this way and get through the problem. But if the external demands require something a little bit different than that, and you use the same old routine, you're not going to get the answer right. And you're going to end up doing something that's not appropriate for the context. And so this is the trouble with perseveration and problems with mental flexibility, is that it can get you into some problems sometimes.
I think somebody wants to hear what perseveration is again.
So there's perseveration, the study. So there's persevere. Right. Perseveration is a cognitive, we call it a deficit, because it's basically reverting to a familiar way of thinking or acting in a particular situation that you continue to repeat or perseverate. You stick on the same task. You stick on the same way of responding all the time.
One way I look at that and what I see in my own person with Parkinson's and with others is I always call it the pincer grasp. Like, they get really honed in on one way to do something, or, you know, and very stubbornly so. And then suddenly you're like, but it would be easier if you did it this way, but they just can't do it that way. Right. And so that's the pathway. And it's funny because a lot of times we think, isn't this something we can change and affect, you know, a more positive outcome for our person and ourselves? And then we can't. So that's interesting that it has a name other than pincer grasp.
I like that, though. That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah. Okay. Polly?
Elizabeth says, I go to counseling, helping me focus on providing as much dignity for my husband, but I think he needs some help too. Should I try to get him to go to couples counseling or single counseling?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think this speaks to a recognition from the care partner who wants to help and thinks that what's helping for that person should also help mm-hmm. for the other person. And, you know, sometimes that's right. Sometimes you know your person with Parkinson's well enough to say, well, you would really benefit if you just put down some of these blocks and you go and we do this thing. But sometimes I think it's important to recognize the individuality of your person. And if you know that he or she is just not going to go and benefit, then obviously you don't want to drag him or her to that sort of thing. So I think it's more about knowing the individual nature of the person you're dealing with, and being open to the fact that this person is dealing with a real, what we call an ego insult. This is a disease that's taking a part of them away from themselves. And they have a definition of who they are up until the age of 62, 65, whenever they were diagnosed with a disease. They know who they are and they have built up this concept of who they are. And this disease has taken away a part of that. And they are no longer that person. And whether they can, you know, verbalize that or tell you that or say, I just feel bad about myself, whatever, or not, they feel it and they know it. And it's this concept of self that's being disruptive. And this is the core of who we are as people. And this is a really scary thing. And the way that we deal with fear around an ego insult is very different. And so you have to respect that this person has got a significant personal struggle or spiritual existential struggle going on in their body that this disease has brought to them, and now they have to deal with. So some of the decisions they make, some of the things that they do, it's in response in a very base level to that initial sort of, who am I as a person? What is this thing doing to me? What's going to happen in the future? So bringing someone to counseling, yes, I would say definitely try it if the person is open to it, if your person wants to do that, or you can cajole or move them along a little bit. But I probably would not force. I probably would not, like, drag someone in. And remember, you can get support. It doesn't have to be through formal psychotherapy or a counselor. It could be through a religious figure if you're involved in your church or other religious organization. It can be a good friend. It can be a sibling or, you know, it's just someone that they can connect with who gets them at that level that they can, they don't even have to address it directly. If they just feel that feeling of support, that somehow they can process and move through this ego insult in a way that they can get out on the other side and not be, have such problems.
Yeah, two things on that. One is ego insult for the care partner too?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And number two is, we did have a chaplain on last time who was very helpful with this regard too, because I think that was, you know, he's in a palliative care, a neuro palliative care practice. And if you're lucky, you can access someone like that as well, who is also dealing with a myriad of other similar people. You know, this is what's helpful. You don't want to reinvent the wheel and have to explain what Parkinson's is. So it really is helpful if you can talk to someone who kind of gets it, you know. Yeah. I don't have to say too much, but this notion of ego insult, that is something I will take with me today. So thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
That's super fascinating. Okay, Polly.
Can you talk, Mary asks if we could talk about how dementia can also lead to apathy?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Ways as a care partner, I can be supportive and help with this symptom.
Yeah, so apathy is a big, it's a really, really difficult issue. And if your person with Parkinson's is struggling with apathy, it is the most, it is by description, the most frustrating thing that you as a supporter, supporting that person with Parkinson's disease, have to deal with, because it looks so willful. It looks like they're actually doing this because they're fighting you, or I just don't care anymore. And it's hard to see your person with Parkinson's disease change from possibly a vibrant, interactive person to someone who just doesn't want to do anything and wants to sit around and doesn't want to get involved. And when, especially when you know that that's good for that person, or you think it might be. Apathy is a real, real tough one. There aren't, I'd have to say that's one of the things that we haven't got great solutions for. The best things that you can do are structure. When you have structure that the person has got anticipation of, I know that on Tuesdays I'm going to my boxing class, or I know that on Wednesdays I'm going to meet the guys for lunch at the diner. I mean, if there's structure and there's things that they can then plan for, again, getting back to this idea of executive function and dysfunction, when you set up these barriers or sort of boundaries that they can then anticipate and plan, it's not a brand new situation. And it's not like something just coming out of the blue with them. They know it's going to happen, and they can get structured into their routine because that's what they do very well. They do things in serial. They, let's do this, and then we're going to do this, not multiple things at the same time. I know what's coming on Wednesday morning, so I can plan my routine and get there. Those are probably the best things as far as dealing with apathy is structure, social support, you know, having people around that support but don't push. Are usually the two best things that I can recommend. There are other things out there, but again, I think a lot of it is also individual, how well you know your person with Parkinson's and meeting them at that level.
So this is good too. Care partners, listen to this. What he's saying too is the structure. You don't always have to provide the structure. The examples he was giving were actually of your person going, either being picked up to go to boxing or, you know, or go, meeting so-and-so somewhere. And so when you're wondering, like, how can I start to cultivate a support team and give myself more of a break? This is this structure will help not only your person, but you, and maybe help you, you know, forestall problems with apathy. But if you are experiencing them, maybe also help you out of them. And you have friends and family who do want to help. I know that, all of you, all of us. And so, you know, it's just so hard to know where to ask, where to start. And I think this is a great notion to think about structure, and then think about who can help you with that. Who can pick up Mary or Fred at 11 o'clock to get them to their 11:30, you know, event, and maybe they won't be home till 1. Hallelujah. Okay. So,
exactly.
All right. This is a great tip. All right. Go, Polly.
Two questions that are related. I'll address them one by one. My spouse has Parkinson's and dementia. I have been taking care of him for about 10 years. I am not doing well myself, depressed, feeling hopeless and helpless. How do I take care of myself physically and, more importantly, emotionally?
Yeah, great, great question. And unfortunately, a common scenario in this sort of dyad between a person with Parkinson's and their care partner is the idea of feeling overwhelmed with the roles and responsibilities, and that leading to feelings of helplessness and all of those things. I think the first thing here is certainly an awareness of this. So the fact that you can recognize this, you're on your way to getting yourself better. I think it's important for you to be selfish at this point, in a way. in that you've got to be thinking about yourself, because if you're not there to help your person with Parkinson's, you're not doing that person any favors by being the martyr or, you know, just pushing through. It's important that you take some time for yourself and really get yourself into the healthiest place that you can get. The first step is to recognize the signs and symptoms of which you've just described beautifully as to what I would call, I'd have a red flag up for a dysthymia or a depression. This might be a depression. There are definitely stressors that come with this job that you've all willingly embraced to take care of your person with Parkinson's. And it's important to know that you need to unleash some of that stuff and the stress that comes with it. And if I think for someone like you, I would encourage you to maybe speak to your primary care doctor at your next visit or make an appointment today to say, I really need to talk to you about this. There are different ways that this can be dealt with. Obviously, there are medications out there that work really well. You just got to find the right one. But then there's also support. There's downloading some of the responsibilities, as we just said, with structure, getting someone to pick up your person at 11 for an 11:30 appointment, you know, building those other support networks that give you some time, even if it's just to go to the grocery store on your own and not have to worry about things, that can be freeing and relaxing and something that, or maybe it's just time on your own. In any event, my point is take care of yourself. It's really critical to do that because your person needs you and you're not your best if you're not at your best.
And step one is to, and then and the next step, now you recognize it, is to seek help. And then starting, I think, with the primary care physician is really the way you want to go. And especially, and don't downplay it either. You need help. Stat. And so, and I think that's important because that will help drive up your capacity to find care and alert them that you are in fact suffering. And you can let your best friend know, or your best, you know, family, the closest family member, let someone else know that the burden is, you know, the strain is too heavy and you need help. So I think there's probably many of us on the call that are in this situation, and this is great advice. And it is difficult to recognize sometime in ourselves.
So I'm a mental health expert. I'm telling you now, I'm giving you the freedom to go and get help for yourself. This is something you need to do. So please take my advice. This is what I give you, is it's okay to be concerned about yourself and to go and do something for yourself.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. Dr. Mapstone is in the house. All right. Thank you so much. What do we got?
Angela asks a related question, Mark, and I don't know if the answer would be any different, but what about dealing with grief and loss from a care partner's perspective? Yeah. How do you address a care partner's grief of the chain?
So grief and loss related to the loss of a partner or a person with, or it just the grief and loss related to increasing dysfunction and disability. I mean, those are obviously different things, and they look differently. Grief and loss, those feelings are healthy. Those are things that you feel. These are things that are the reality of the situation. And this is a reflection of your ego insult. This is how you are feeling because things are being changed in your environment, in your dyad with your person with Parkinson's disease, in yourself as a person and what you're capable of. And maybe you're not as competent as you thought you were in certain areas. Maybe your relationship has changed with your person with Parkinson's. It certainly will have. So grief and feelings of loss are, in my opinion, part of the normal process of struggling with a monumental change that's happening both in your life and in your person with Parkinson's life. And it affects everything. It affects your extended family, your communities, you know, organizations around you. So this is a significant thing. And this is a major cause of the disability around these diseases. So I would say grief and loss is something that I wouldn't say is out of the normal realm, as it's probably a natural process of dealing with these changes. And if it feels like you then progress to hopelessness and helplessness and feelings of like, well, I can't do this anymore, then I think we go back to the discussion that we just had of go to your primary care doctor and say, this is moving from feelings of loss and grief and feeling like I'm sad to I'm now feeling hopeless and helpless and I'm feeling depressed, because again, that needs to be addressed.
And can we drill into the fact too that you're not you haven't, you know, you probably feel like you're failing your person or you're failing yourself by not being able to do that, right? And it's just not, this is like a normal outcome of this burden and strain. It's just, and it's your body's way of also saying, I need help, and figuring out where to get it. And also, if you're just having inklings of this feeling, start to find, look for that help, right? I think that's so important.
And the fact that you're on this call today is like so empowering, I hope, that you're reaching out to people who know something about the process that are in similar situations as you. This is again, that first step to getting out and actually getting the support you need. That's why I think all these is a support meetup. You know, this is support. This is what you need. And you can get more of this personalized to yourself by engaging friends and other family members, clergy, professional psychologists, counselors, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I hope everybody's taking this to heart, because this is why we're here. We're here to talk about how we can really help ourselves and to recognize the way to do that. And it's important that we understand our person with Parkinson's and their challenges and how to help them cope and manage. But we're not very good if we can't take care of ourselves. And we all feel it, right, at some level. And some of you, I'm sorry if some of you are really new to the meetup and also newly diagnosed, because this may sound overly heavy to you, but this is also your warning, or, you know, kind of just that putting the flag up to say, you will need help. It's not, you know, if, it's when. And so figuring out who those helpful people are, and also figuring out who the unhelpful people are, is another part of the equation. And I know we're quickly running out of time, but this is so important. And it's so important too. And it leads into, you know, all the questions we're going to ask you next time, Mark, because you are coming back next month. It's so important. We will look at all the questions in the chat that we've missed. And we do appreciate you for chiming in and also for supporting each other, because a big part of this is when you weigh in with something that works for you and other people see it, it helps them. So continue to do that and continue to remember that you're helping each other. And sometimes you're even helping me and Matt. And I know we're informing Mark in his practice. Whenever he hears, you know, workarounds or different, you know, what your concerns are, it reestablishes what's important. Okay. So we're going to be back on this topic. We will try to write it up. I'm sorry. So really sorry we couldn't get to more. But I'm also so happy we covered a lot. Mm-hmm. We covered a lot, Mark. Thank you so much.
Yeah. My pleasure. It is always great to be a part of this group. I really love coming, and this is really what I enjoy. I'd also point you to the resource book that the Davis Finney Foundation puts out, where a lot of these topics are covered in great detail and with excellent, well thought out recommendations. It's a free resource. They'll mail it to you. You just write and ask for it. Get a copy. I've got copies on my bookshelf back here. I give them to patients all the time.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for that shout out. And that's really true. And I also want to remind people that Pat Donahue and Gail Gittin, who's normally here with us, are ambassadors for the Davis Finney Foundation. And you can find them through the foundation website as well. And I think that's important for you to know, because sometimes you need a follow up. And so don't be shy. Reach out. Pat, thanks so much for
welcome. Hey, you know, there's always the lights at the end of the tunnel. It's always there. I've been through a lot of this in the last couple months. And there's always a light and there's hope.
Thank you for that. And that's a good reminder too, is to kind of look for that light at the end of the tunnel when it feels pretty bleak. But we're here for you. We'll be back right after Labor Day, right?
Yeah, September 3rd, we're back.
Thanks, all right. Everyone. Thank you, Paula.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark. Thanks,
you got it. All right, see you next month.
Bye.